Thank you, Mr. Henderson, and good afternoon. Sorry, good morning to you all. Let me get that straight. It's usually afternoon here and morning the other direction, but we'll get it straight. We didn't include much information about our light luncheon and snacks after services, sort of welcome you home from the feast. We figured this congregation needs no instruction about eating. So it will be available there, and I think you'll find some of those who have issues with the gluten-free, that you'll find the sandwiches are actually gluten-free. So those of us who don't need them, stand back and let the gluten-free bunch in first before you go for that. There are lots of wraps to enjoy as well and a few other things. So that was for the Sabbath welcome home from the feast. Do keep in mind the fact that we do have several neighboring congregations that are not meeting today. If you watched In Accord this week, you heard Mr. Franks talk about some of the issues resulting from infections either obtained traveling to or from the feast, or perhaps even there. And as he pointed out, Rapid City was the hardest hit, and that includes some of our ministry as well. So please do keep them in mind. I know that Buffalo has canceled. Mr. Messerly is one of the ones. The whole family got COVID. He's slower to recover than Jen and the girls, and they're not even home yet from out west. They're somewhere in Nebraska, the last we heard last night. So I know they would appreciate your prayers. Akron-Canton has canceled. Pittsburgh has canceled. Wheeling has canceled. So we are sort of an island in the area here. Cleveland had its bout with COVID before the feast, as all of us know very well, and it appears that we have been mercifully spared a second round for the most part. We certainly have those to be praying about. Please keep them. Williams is in your prayers, Ray and Renee, and Jason's been visiting them. He needs to get back to Texas to his job. And Andrew Travers also tested positive. He was in Alaska for the feast, so there were a handful even from there as well. So do keep them all in your prayers and thoughts. I don't know other congregations that had to cancel their services. It just seemed that in doing our due diligence, we did not have a major problem here. Those who were dealing with it were aware and quarantining. And some sites were virtually untouched. In Orange Beach, we only had one case the entire festival, and that was of one lady and a family that they were not planning to come to services anyway. They were watching on the web the whole time. One family of three began to show symptoms after returning from the feast, but that was it from a site of over 800 people registered. So some sites were virtually untouched, and others did have difficulties. As Mr. Franks pointed out, though, based on the attendances and the registrations, we know that probably close to or up to maybe even 20% of those who did go to the feast site areas, and of course, they're well aware of God's instructions about that, but stayed in their accommodations and watched the website from their local feast site in the area. So we know from attendances that was certainly true in Orange Beach where we were. We were registered with 825 in a site that typically has walk-ins that show up unannounced who didn't even register. And yet our highest attendance was only 713. So that's 112 shy of the registration, let alone walk-ins. And our average attendance was more like about 650. So we know that that was going on, and that's certainly understandable given the concerns of our time. In tracking some of these numbers, it appears that some of the incidences of the COVID, the Delta variant, it's some areas it is dropping. That's a good thing. We hope to see that continue. Please do keep those involved or affected in your prayers as we ask God to guide us in going forward. FI has resumed classes this past Monday, as you know, and my wife and I next leave for FI is in about 8 weeks. 8 weeks from Monday, we'll be heading down to begin teaching again the first module of Modern Church History in early December. Well, where did the time go? We already know what some people were involved during the feast, doing during the feast. I can sympathize with Mr. David Rushton. The last time that we had some serious fishing in our family was many years ago on one of our cabin retreats in eastern Ontario, based on when we lived up near in Ottawa. We used to go from Ohio for a number of years, and my son and I were convinced we were good fishermen. My wife grabbed her fishing pole one morning while we grumpy, complaining men were asking what was for breakfast. She said, "I'm on vacation too. Fix it yourself." She grabbed her fishing pole, and on her second cast, she pulled in a 6-pound, 30-inch northern pike, which fed 7 of us for dinner. It was half as tall as she was, basically, pretty close. And she took home the trophy that year and all years for the biggest fish caught. So I sympathize with you, David. Kudos to your wife, Sarah. Congratulations. Good job. These are the way things happen. So we know what some were involved in during the feast. But you know, wasn't it just a few moments ago that we were keeping the Day of Atonement? Feels like it. Wishing each other, have a wonderful feast. And saying, see you when we get back, comments. We are home from the feast. Now what? Now what? This happens to be one of those leap years, intercalary years on the Hebrew calendar, so the days all shift a little bit later next year. And we'll just have to wait, perhaps, until they show up. Next year's Feast of Trumpets is on September 26th. A date that this year was day 6 of the Feast of Tabernacles. So it'll be a bit later next year. I guess when you say, now what, it depends on what you mean by what. It could mean, what did we learn at the feast? It could mean, how much of it will we retain in our minds? It could mean, how much of it will we practice in our lives? You heard references to that, both in the opening prayer and in the sermonette. It could mean how much will we use the material to make substantive changes in our lives spiritually. Because just knowing it doesn't accomplish very much. We know from the scriptures that we're told that even the demons believe and they tremble, but they don't do anything about it. So where are we? It could mean how determined we are to let it give us a renewed energy and focus on what this calling is all about. And it seems, at least as we experienced it, my wife and I talked about it at the feast in Orange Beach, the word focus was a big word. What's our focus? Those are a lot of things to think about. Now comes the serious question, how will we do? How will we do? Not always what will we do, but how will we do? And that's perhaps the most important question of all. And that's where we find ourselves right now. How can we cling to what we heard? Years and years and years ago, I remember hearing in the feast sermons about post-feast letdown. Well, we may not use the phrase as often as we used to, but there's a certain validity to it. It is tough. You know, it's a spiritual high point of the year. We go, we have the chance to hear about 3 months' worth of sermons in an 8-day period of time. We are able most years to fellowship freely. This year it was a little bit hindered, but still we were able to be on site with many other brethren. In some areas there wasn't too much hindrance of it. I found it a little bit sad. Mr. Sandilands was telling me that even last year, as tough as things were and making adjustments sort of on the fly at the last minute, he said, you know, sadly, he said, I think I ran into more attitude issues this year than I did last year. And I thought, that's rather sad. That's rather sad. There were some who took exception to the fact that they were asked to pick a seat. They could choose from the seating map where they wanted to be seated, but then they were asked to just sit there every day so that we can maintain some sort of social distancing during at least the seated part of the services. And that's something that's a little hard to understand, to be blunt. How will we cling to what we heard? How will we live what we heard? How will we translate the words into actions, into attitude changes? How will we change because of what we heard? Those are the questions to ask. So let's start with what might be the most obvious and basic lesson of the feast. It's a lesson that has to be learned by all of God's servants, even those who we believe never had the opportunity to keep God's annual feast, because we find no record of the annual festivals before Exodus 12. And yet there were saints before that time, as we all well know, throughout the book of Genesis, which covers almost half of recorded human history to this point. About 2,500 years is covered in the book of Genesis. a lot of time. It's in the book of Hebrews that I'm thinking about. Hebrews chapter 11. When I say Hebrews 11, most of you will immediately recognize that chapter name or nickname or whatever you want to call it. We call it the faith chapter for a good reason. Mr. David Johnson has given a sermon fairly recently where he was talking about this, and he mentions that as he understands it, he's a bit of a wordsmith, which I appreciate because you learn a lot that way. This is the F.I. David Johnson, not the My Brother David Johnson. I think we get that point. Somebody was telling us they were at the feast in Hawaii, and when I said my brother was there, they said, well, I didn't think that was the instructor from Foundation Institute. He didn't look like that at all that he was speaking. I said, no, that was my brother. Oh, I've got to tell our friends that was his brother. So anyway, the other David Johnson explains that to him this is more of a description than a definition, or at least as much a description. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. He says for him that describes it. It's worth thinking about. You drop down to verse 6, and it says, but without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, step 1, and 2, that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. It doesn't say lackadaisically seek him. It doesn't say haphazardly seek him. It doesn't say when it feels okay to seek him. It says diligently. It is effort to be a converted Christian. We should know that. Verse 13, we drop down to get the context I'm driving at. After listing some of those big names we know from the early years, many of them from, in fact, all of them in the early days from the book of Genesis, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. This is not permanence for us. That's the irony of it. The things that we are able to pick up with our five senses, the physical senses, are the things that are illusory. The things we can't really see or register, those are the permanent things. Think of the servant of Elisha who couldn't see the armies, or Elijah, sorry, armies round about him. And he asked God, open his eyes that he may see. We don't know if the prophet ever saw them. Maybe he did, but maybe he just knew they were there. And he says there were armies, there were horses and chariots of fire round about him. Those are not normally visible. I think I'd be scared to death if I could see them. But that's what's lasting. Those who say such things, after it talks about assure them, embrace them, confess they were strangers and pilgrims, those who say those things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. This is not our focus in life. Now we're here. We should make the best of it and set a good example by God's standards while we're doing it. You heard about that in the sermonette. Truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, countries in italics, it's probably hard to determine what would be the best way to describe what's being talked about. Country comes as close as anything else. Spanish is helpful because it has different words, two different words for country. One means the nation you're in, and the other one means like the countryside. So it's a little easier to determine what you're talking about. If they had called to mind that place, that focus, that origin, that country from which they'd come out, that life, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better. That becomes their focus. That is a heavenly residence, country, focus, existence, place to be. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Now, that city is not going to be revealed, we're shown in the book of Revelation, until God's plan is complete, in the sense that all of those who have demonstrated their response to God's calling will already be spirit beings in his family when the new heavens and the new earth appear, the new Jerusalem. That's the city. Then it goes into examples throughout the book. And finally, in the last two verses, throughout the chapter, I should say, verse 39 and verse 40, these all, having described so many and things they went through, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Tradition says Paul wrote this letter to Hebrews. We don't know who it was, if it wasn't Paul. We'll find out for certain, I guess, in the resurrection. But I'd like to ask you to take some time to slowly read through and think about all those verses we just went over. What do they tell us? What do they tell us? If you listen to this week's In Accord, you heard Mr. Franks talk about two deaths recently, one before the feast. Neither one of these were COVID-related. And one, both of them involved longtime members. One was a gentleman from New England before the feast, and one man from Texas who was at the feast in Hawaii while on a beach walk or an outing with his family, dropped dead of a heart attack. Now, for him, does it get any better than that? You're at the feast, you're with your family, you're walking on the beach, suddenly things go black, and your next moment of consciousness, you are approaching the Mount of Olives with Jesus Christ and the saints from all times. I don't know if it gets any better than that. We knew a gentleman many years ago who died at the feast while he was playing golf with some of his buddies. Just keeled over from a heart attack on the golf course. And I would add the same thought there. He loved golf. His first question is probably going to be, did I get a par on that hole? And they're going to say, you did better than par, my friend. You did better than par. Look where you are now. But you can imagine how difficult this past feast was for those two families. And it will be very hard for both of them, I'm sure, both families, as they approach the feast every year, because it will be a kind of a memory too and a memorial. But if they focus on God's way, they can focus on the future and focus on how much it will be a wonderful reunion. Then, of course, you also heard him point out two key statistics, more like estimates, really, as the news is still coming in. One was the extrapolation. I already mentioned that roughly 20% of the total church registration, or the total numbers of people registered for the 12 U.S. feast sites, must have watched the services online, because we compare the attendances to actual attendances at the services. Where Jim Allen and I were in Orange Beach, I've already mentioned, 825 registration, 713 average, or high attendance, average about more six, like 625, 650 average. The fact that about 90 cases, he said, of COVID-19 have come from the Rapid City site. He was very upfront about it. I had talked to Mark Wynant, the feast coordinator, Monday. That's 5 days ago now, and it was 76 at that point. And then I learned of two others. And that made it 78, but clearly there were another dozen beyond that. Significant numbers from Lancaster, several from two more sites that surfaced after the feast, as he related. The other eight U.S. feast sites reported none or a very few, like Orange Beach, very few. One during the feast, three after, shortly afterwards. Those things are difficult to hear, but I am glad that he faced them up front and just said, this is what it was. This is where we were. That's not an easy decision to make. As you mull over things like that, think about the burden that rests on his shoulders. He's not asking me to say that. I'm just observing it. You have to make a call. God issues a command. And yet we also need to be wise and not take undue risks. I was 11 years a camp director. I know about risk management. You cannot avoid it all. Had we avoided any risks at Camp Heritage, we'd have had everybody sit in their tents and play, checkers for a 7-week camp. I assure you that would not have been a popular activity. So we did things like whitewater rafting. Is that without risk? Nope. As we found out very clearly one year where we had somebody life flighted to Pittsburgh. But God was with us, and He protected that young lady. So you do what you can, and then ask God's help. We also heard of other Church of God fellowships, denominations, sites that had significant or even higher numbers of COVID. And I hope that we are sympathetic to and praying for all who were so afflicted in trying to obey God's command. What's the key lesson? Key lesson, Hebrews 11:13. This life is temporary, just like our dwellings at the feast. You notice how quickly you can spread out in a place when you go to the Feast of Tabernacles? You get into your hotel, or if you have an apartment or a condo, you know, and in 45 minutes, it looks like you've been there for a year and a half. And you have everything figured out. You know where all of your clothes are, which drawers they're in. You know where stuff is in the refrigerator. Unless, of course, you're sharing a condo with another family and then they hide things from you deliberately. I don't know that for sure, but, you know, we can ask around. I'm sure we'll find out. But, you know, it's temporary. And the feast does fly past. My wife extracted a promise from me. I spoke at the opening night in Orange Beach, and then I had a sermon on day 7. She said, on the opening night service, please do not say the feast is almost over. I have no idea why she said that. I don't know who. Oh, yes, I do. Because I remember saying that specifically probably close to 20 years ago on the opening night one night, looking around saying the feast is almost over, and I got the look. Well, I got the look, and I didn't even say anything this year. Somebody else did, though. Within a day or two, somebody said, this is going to be over before you know it, and I kind of nudged her in the ribs, but it didn't do any good. Gently, of course. But that's the lesson. 8 days go by, you pack up your stuff, and you look around you, and it's almost kind of sad. That was your temporary home. But folks, so is this life. This is temporary. That's the lesson. Another thought touched us during the feast in different ways. It was suggested by a scripture reference that was raised probably 2 or 3 times at least where we were, and that's from Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. It's in the middle of a prophecy that involves more detail of the end time fulfillments of that fourth beast of Daniel 7, the final world ruling empire of that image there. It says in Daniel 7:23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings that will arise from this kingdom. And another shall rise after them. He'll be different from the first, and he'll subdue 3 kings. So we're talking about, in our understanding of prophecy, the various iterations of the Roman Empire, the original and its various resurrections. Now, speaking of that final one and this great loud speaking horn that subdues 3, it says, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. New King James says he shall persecute the saints of the Most High and intend to change times and law. And the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time, 3.5 times, 3.5 years, the great tribulation. My Bible has a marginal reference for the word persecute. It says that it could be translated, and apparently it says literally it means wear out. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High. That came up in our feast experience this year quite a bit. It made us think. And we thought about this lesson. And it's not just because of the coronavirus pandemic, although that's a factor, certainly. But the question is, don't the trends and the directions and the events, and yes, the pandemic, what's going on around us, the way social media is destroying society, the way it's being used, and events in our world just right now make you tired? Don't they just make you tired of it all? Are we tired of man's misrule? Are we tired of Satan's ploys? Are you tired of spam calls on your phone? Or even spam texts on your cell phone? My phone's gotten smart enough to weed most of those out, but every once in a while something gets through. Are you tired of Satan's confusing people? Are you tired of human stubbornness and refusal to listen? Are you as tired of it if you see it in yourself? That would be a more pointed question. Don't you pray those words more fervently all the time from Matthew 6 and verse 10? Your kingdom come. Even knowing what lies ahead. I spoke on day 7 at the feast, and one of the key focuses of the sermon was on what does it mean when it says in Revelation 20 and verse 3, by God's reckoning, it says about Satan being released for a short season, it says something to the effect, this must happen. What does that mean? It must happen. This is God's inspiration. It says, after these things, he must be released for a little while. Why? We just got rid of him once. There's a reason for it, and I won't go into that today. You can find it if you want to look it up. And I'll give you some hints. There's no verse you can turn to that says, here's the exact reason, but we can begin to list results, and we can begin to learn to try to think as God thinks. Are we aware of these things? What are the lessons are buried deep in the faith chapter of Hebrews 11? Well, here's one that is sort of like one of those dumb questions. How about faith? Verse 6, we read it, without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Do we know that? Those two things. Do our lives reflect it? Then there's another lesson to glean in verses 14, 15, and 16, and that is that this world, its way, its society, its ideas of right and wrong is not our world. Those who say these things about being strangers and pilgrims are stating, that is, you are making a statement. You heard that phrase before, so-and-so made a statement. And they don't mean literally, they mean something that person, he or she did. That made a statement. That's what this is. Those who say these things are making a statement. And the statement is, I'm seeking a homeland. This isn't my home. Truly, if they had called to mind that homeland from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. If that's what their focus really was, they'd find a way to get back there. But now they desire a better. Their focus has changed. Their focus is on something that exists only now around God's throne in the third heaven. And the government that will set that system up is going to return in the person of Jesus Christ. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Doesn't it follow that if we don't have that focus, he is ashamed? He has prepared a city for them. This is not our world. How deeply do we understand that? Do we understand the premise from Philippians 3, verses 20 and 21 about our citizenship is from heaven? Do we get that? Do we live like we get that? I have a question for you today, and it sort of matches what I talked about a little bit in the opening night of the feast. I was focused on the feast there, but I would apply it to our lives here and now. Has anything distracted you from your goal? We live in a world that is filled with distractions, far more than we ever used to. You know, for many of us, we remember going to school when some of the biggest problems were students chewing gum when they shouldn't be in school and, you know, sticking it under their desks, or if you go a little further back, grabbing the girls' pigtails in front of you and dipping it in the inkwell. Now, that's before my time. But so we used to hear about things like that. It's a lot different now. So, question. Has anything distracted you from your goal, from your homeland in the last year, in the last 6 months, in the last week, or essentially since getting home from the feast? It's easy to get distracted. What's your answer? Think about it and let me reminisce just a bit. Because you see, I can't answer those questions for you, and you can't answer them for me. It's a very personal thing. Why is that? Well, 2 Corinthians chapter 5 gives us a clue and a hint. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7 says, "For we walk by faith, not by sight." Because what we see is all around us. And if that's all we have, wow. Better mail it in, because it ain't looking good these days. Verse 8, "We are confident. Yes, we are well pleased. Rather to be absent from the body and be present with the Lord." That's the future. Doesn't mean we want to die and go to heaven. I think we all understand that. But we do realize that the last breath and moment of one who has been called by God and is called, chosen, and faithful is going to be with that Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, we make it our aim, our goal, our purpose in life, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to Him, because that's what counts. That's where the future is. "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad." And remember, these letters are written to the church. They don't really apply that directly to the uncalled world yet. The beauty of God's plan is it will. That's the beauty of the meaning of the eighth day, the last great day. The understanding that everybody will have an opportunity to learn. Can you imagine the mammoth task that's going to be? The man who gave the sermonette at the feast in Orange Beach on day 7, just before I spoke, was also from St. Louis. I was born there. I moved when I was 5, so I have very little recollection. But he talked about how the business about Satan having to be released. He said, "It strikes me," he said, "if you've ever been to one of these, to a zoo or safaris or whatever," he said, "he strikes me like a caged lion, pacing back and forth, waiting. When is that cage door going to go up so I can spring out again?" That's the world we live in now. Where do we want to be when things change? The feast experience is part of that process. The feast and the last great day are big deals in God's mind and in His plan. We spent some time with some amazing people this feast. I hope you did too. And when you do you find lives like that, people like that, inspiring? It's wonderful to see that. They are inspiring. God's people are inspiring. And we can all learn from each other. We can learn lessons. We can be taught lessons by seeing quiet and determined and continued obedience. Focus on what's truly important. And I keep coming back to that word. How's your focus? How's my focus? What do you think, I'll ask a question, is most important to God about the future He plans? What's most important to God? Is it the fact that the church will be taken to a place of safety during the Great Tribulation? That's physical. Think bigger. Expand the focus. Is it the fact that the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them? You recognize the reference. That's physical. Expand the focus. Is it thinking of people beating their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks? That's physical. Expand the focus. Is that how we think of the kingdom, as something physical? There's an application of that. We talk about a kingdom, you know, we've taught for years that it's got to have rulers, laws, territory, subjects. But that's the way we use it in a physical sense. But expand the focus. It's important for us to regularly examine our own hearts and minds and see if our focus has changed in some way. God's word is very clear on what could follow if we lose that focus. It's several places you could turn. Solomon being a very compelling case study in what can happen if we let the sharpness of the focus get fuzzy. And make no mistake, it can get fuzzy. Sin causes fuzziness. My wife and I had our appointments with the optometrist yesterday, annual appointments. I think, you know, as you get older, things get fuzzy too, but that's a little different. That's physical. Expand the focus, I would say. She has a little story from the feast. She was walking the beach one morning on the first holy day because we had just an afternoon service, and she had her sunglasses on, but she had her regular prescription glasses with her, so she sort of tucked them, you know, in the front of the shirt there, and then she saw a pretty shell down by the water's edge, and she bent down to pick it up. She came back, and I looked at her and I said, "Where are your glasses?" That was the most expensive shell we ever got from the feast. And you know, the funny thing was, those silly dolphins, they didn't turn it in. We'd see them every morning out there. We looked for one with glasses on, you know, sort of like that old movie years ago with Don Knotts, The Incredible Mr. Limpet, sort of like that. But they never turned them in during the feast. So she wore her piano glasses for the rest of the feast. Those are the glasses she had made with her reading prescription only, distance out about 3 feet in front of her so she can play the piano carefully when she's doing that. But you know, it's kind of hard to walk around with piano glasses on all the time. The key to this experience is, pardon me, but you know, we had an extra set of glasses in the glove box of my car, which was parked in our garage back home because we decided we would rent a car for the feast this year and save a little wear and tear on our car. So when we got home, we forgot that they were, we checked and we didn't find them immediately because she was wearing her piano glasses so she couldn't see them. We found them a week later. She's had them on for 24 hours and she's happy as a clam, as they say. Or as a clean fish, at least, taking a lesson from Mr. Rushton's sermonette. Focus, focus, focus. Luke 9:62. Those who put their hand to the plow and look back are not fit for the kingdom of God. Focus, focus, focus. We had some fine messages in Orange Beach this year, and I hope you did where you attended God's feast. I'd like to reference a few of the ones we heard today because it seemed to me that some of them were mainly asking us to say, "How's your focus?" Mr. Horchak spoke to us early in the feast on the first holy day about the fact that God's feasts highlight, and the Feast of Tabernacles particularly, highlights a stark difference from what we live in foretaste at the feast. Contrasted with the world around us and its system, hope versus hopelessness. Do we have that focus? It seemed to me that's what he was asking. Mr. Frank's message was heard at all sites, the Father of mercies and God of all comforts. Wasn't that a wonderful way to put it based on the scripture? The Father of mercies and God of all comforts. He also contrasted the world today with the world to come. He stressed that without those two wonderful characteristics God has, there would be no salvation. There would be no mercy. There would be no comfort. Is that our focus too? Mr. Sandilands, our feast coordinator and pastor in New Orleans and Laurel, Mississippi, spoke to us about the reversing of the diaspora. That's the phrase that is usually used by the Jews to describe the scattering of the Jews following the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., but his point was to stress the difference between this temporary existence and eternity. And again, I would ask, do we understand that focus? Mr. McConaughey and Mr. Lukey both spoke to us by taking the approach of trying to answer questions that come up. Mr. McConaughey talked about that's what our future's going to be. He said, we're going to be answering questions. That's what priests do, is teach. Mr. Lukey took the approach of, having worked extensively with camp and youth programs, he had made it compile a list over years of common questions from young people, and he just tried to sort of march through them and answer questions about the future. Mr. Demarest, Roy Demarest, spoke to us very energetically on the last great day in the morning, and then we lost power and lost our transmission halfway through for those attending in Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky. I assure you he finished strongly despite his vertigo that day. You noticed he was sitting down. He had enough trouble moving around just to get up there. But he talked about people crying for joy, contrasting it with the crying that is usually a part of this world. Focus, how wonderful that will that be when crying mostly denotes joy. I spoke twice, once on opening night, on being sure we left the world behind us to come to the feast with God's focus. I even urged everybody, I sure hope you brought an extra suitcase to take some of the feast home with you. And on day 7, the title was Step Into Eternity, by trying to answer some of the puzzling questions inherent in events at the end of the millennium, especially Satan being released. God's word says he must be released. Why? Can we try to see that through God's eyes with his focus? Why is that so important? Mr. Britton Taylor had 2 very memorable messages after giving me an extreme hard time in one of his introductions, because we have so much in common. Our backgrounds, oddly enough, pattern each other. We were both born in St. Louis. We were both born in 1951. My family moved to Springfield, Missouri. His family has 6 generations of Taylors buried in Springfield. He moved to Kansas City when he was 11. I moved to Kansas City when I was 11. As he said, he has a younger sister, and I have a younger brother. He said, Doug's first date was my younger sister. Then he said, I just want to be clear, though, my first date was not his younger brother. So, we went to high school together. What are you going to do with a guy like that? But he spoke about his first message on day 5, when he returned from a kidney infection bout to speak, was which horse will you ride? He talked about Jesus Christ riding a donkey as the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, an animal that denotes peace, no challenge. You're not coming to conquer when you ride on a donkey. It would be kind of ludicrous. But then, he says, when he returns, he will be mounted on a magnificent white stallion. But he talked about the fact, do we know which horse to ride in our lives? He said, we're all too much anxious and too prone to jump on that stallion and whip the sword out of the scabbard. And most of the time, he said, we probably should be riding the donkey. That was a worth listening to message. Is our focus that way? Humble and yielding to God, or valiant on his behalf when that's called for? Do we know the difference? He gave the final sermon of the whole time on how we discern the world and our part in it, through the eyes of the gods of this world or the eyes of the only God. He titled it The Great Healing of the Last Great Day. What's our focus? I'd like to take the rest of the time with something that never came up directly at the feast this year, but was inherent in almost everything. There were 1 or 2 passing references, and that's all. And yet the focus is all about the meaning of where we were, what we were doing, and it's in Matthew 20. Matthew 20. It's one of a series of what we call the kingdom parables. Matthew 20, verse 1, the kingdom of heaven, that denotes possession, not geography. I'm sure we realize that. Matthew uses that term almost exclusively. Is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Now, when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, that's a Roman penny, he sent them into the vineyard. Notice, well, comment, agreed. He went out about the 3rd hour, 9 a.m., and he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. He says, you also go to the vineyard, and whatever is right, I'll give you. So they went. He went out about the 6th hour, noon, 9th hour, 3 o'clock, and did likewise. And the 11th hour, 5 in the afternoon, almost quitting time. He went out and found others standing idle, and he said, "Why have you been standing idle here all day?" And they said, "Because no one hired us." He said, "Well, you go to the vineyard, and whatever is right, you'll receive." So when evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, "Call the laborers, give them their wages. You start with the last, and then work backwards to the first ones." When those who came were hired, who were hired about the 11th hour, they each received a denarius. Can you imagine the ones who were hired at 6 a.m.? Woohoo, look at that. They worked 1 hour, and they got a denarius. Can you imagine what we're going to get? When they had received it, when the first came, it says, they supposed they would receive more. Yeah, I guess, that's human nature. They likewise received the denarius. What? When they had received it, they complained, they grumbled against the landowner. What does that sound like to you, biblically and historically? Sounds like murmuring Israelites to me. They said, "Look, these last men have worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal." Look at that, the accusation. "You did this. You made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the heat of the day." He answered one of them and said, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Didn't you agree with me for a denarius?" Here's the agreement. Here's the contract. What made you think that it would change? It would have changed. "Take what's yours, go your way. I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. Isn't it lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? Is your eye evil because I'm good? Because I'm so generous to somebody else, did that mean that I cheated you out of something you expected?" No, that's not the way humans think, is it? I guarantee you that would pass no union clauses that I can think of. So the last will be first, and the first last. Some gospel accounts say many that are first will be last, and so on. "For many are called, but few are chosen." Wonder why that is. Some have opportunities, and then there are other parables that talk about that. You know, the seed falling on good ground, among weeds, among thorns, etc., etc., etc. We ought to recognize the basic categories and what they signify, I think. The landowner, that's God the Father, I'm sure we understand. He owns the vineyard. He chooses the laborers. Recognize a verse that would match with that? How about John 6:44? Who and how and when he decides. Some he calls and they live an entire life in his service. Some he calls when they're maybe in their early adulthood. Some he calls in the prime of life. Some he calls 5 years before they die. That's up to him, isn't it? It's up to him. It's his work. It's his field. It's his vineyard. It's his plan. The steward, that I think we could say compares to Jesus Christ. He paid the price in his own life. He's the one who pays out the wages to the laborers at the end of the day as he determines is fair. As he and his father, I guess you'd say, as he and the landowner determined is fair. The laborers, for their part, must all of them work till the end of the shift, right? They all work till end of shift. In this case, that's a physical lifetime to receive those wages. The workers are those who are hired to do the work. They have an offer of employment made to them, which they all accepted, every one. It was their choice to accept, and they were clear before they ever did that about the nature of the work to be done, the amount of their wages. That was made clear to them all before they accepted. What was not made clear at the beginning of the shift were things like the amount of work to be done, the weight of the produce they would harvest, the weight they would be asked to carry perhaps, the hours they would work, the intensity of the heat they would have to bear up under. That was not made clear. Those things had to be dealt with as they occurred, as they happened. And they had to work to the end of the shift in order to have the steward pay them their agreed upon wages. That was the deal. Does that sound like anything you and I know? How about our lives of service? There were four categories of workers. That's interesting to look at too. There were the long-time workers. Long time. There were the early morning workers. There were the middle of the day workers. I guess you could say both the ones hired at noon, the sixth hour, and the ones at three, the ninth hour, were both middle of the day workers in a way. And then there were the end of shift workers. I need a few more workers to get done what I need to get done. And I'm going to call a few more right now and shove them out into the vineyard. Let's get it wrapped up. Get it done. Each of those categories of laborers has a comparison category among us, folks. The parable of the kingdom of God is like, the kingdom of heaven is like, the modern laborers in the Father's vineyard. Can you identify who we are? What describes us? Where we fit? How we will fulfill our calling? Do you see why the focus still fits? Thumbnail sketch for you. Where do you fit in that description? Can you pick yourself out in this parable? Long-time laborers. What characterizes them? What challenges do they have? Well, they need to hold on to the vision. Knowing God the Father individually and personally chose us to labor in His vineyard. And in our case, if we're talking long-time laborers, probably when we were young. That hasn't changed. What's the danger? Well, in verse 15, these people thought, verse 10 and 11, their complaints, verse 12 and verse 15, the answer, they expected more because of their long service. There's a warning for that, or for us in that. There's a warning for us in that. Reminder, James 1, verses 17 to 18, God's character is unchanging. God's character is unchanging. Nothing casts a shadow to make it unclear. His purpose never varies. In Peter's account in Mark chapter 10, in verses 28 to 31, I'll hold your place in Matthew, we will be back, but in Mark 10, verse 28, it says, Peter, this is a similar concept. Peter begins to list some of the things that long-time laborers tend to have done. He says, this isn't the account of the parable, but just a similarity. Peter said to him, "See, we've left all and followed you." And Jesus answered, "Assuredly, I say to you, there's no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's, who won't receive 100-fold now in this time, houses, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, lands, with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and the last first." The moral is the same. Sometimes those who are long-time laborers tend to tire, tend to wear out, tend to lose the vision. Long-time laborers have to hold the vision, not give up the focus. We have to work until the end of shift. And we know what that is. Early morning laborers in Matthew 20. In God's church now are many second, third, fourth, even occasionally fifth generation Christians. They all essentially began working early in the morning, but not from, you know, the crack of dawn. At a young age, maybe some cases even from birth. You know, there's the phenomenon in 1 Corinthians 7:14 of being sanctified by the calling of the parents. I won't address that now. You're probably familiar with it. If not, go back and reread 1 Corinthians 7. This group still has to make the choice to accept the calling and agree to the wages. Still have to make the same choice. Psalm 119 records so many points along these lines, and David's description of God's purposes and his life and how it means, what it means to serve Him. It's one of these poetically acrostic psalms. David asks in Psalm 119, verse 9, hold your place in Matthew, "How can a young man cleanse his way?" This is like the early morning laborers, acquainted with it in their young life. "By taking heed to your word, same as all the others. With my whole heart I've sought you. Let me not wander from your commandments. Your word I've hidden in my heart that I might not sin against you. Blessed are you, O Eternal. Teach me your statutes. With my lips I've declared all the judgments of your mouth. I've rejoiced in the way of your testimonies as much as in all riches. I will meditate on your precepts and I will contemplate your ways. I will delight myself in your statutes. I will not forget your word. I'll keep my focus. Most frequently, the early morning laborers are also long-time laborers with some of the same exhortations applying. I think my wife and I could count ourselves in both of those camps, having become acquainted with God's truth as children, or in her case, a young teen, and we're still here. We can't make excuses. We have to stay focused. We also have to work until the end of shift. Jesus Christ hasn't come back when some of us thought he might. So what? The shift continues. The work isn't done. Midday laborers, these folks called on their own, distinct from other family members, most often as adults, I would say. Disruption of life, middle of the day, middle of life, disruptions. If I make this choice, what's it going to mean within my family? If I make this choice, what's going to happen on my job? Since I go out and catch lobsters for a living. Watch out for humpback whales, for one thing. You know, that's like coming to God's church from the world. In Matthew 20, it refers to this group as standing idle in the marketplace, verses 3 and 6. And the steward hires some of them from that background. They're standing idle in the marketplace. They're not actively working in the vineyard of the landowner. They're not actively doing God's work for a certain part of their lives. They're at a stage in life where they can work. They're hale and hearty and they're healthy. They could be working, but they're not. That's an analogy and a comparison to when we learn of God's way to throw ourselves into that part of life. All right, midday laborers, what's the challenge? They come from all different kinds of backgrounds and ideas. Well, I think, and of course our world is filled with, well, I think, and you know, from the biblical point of view, not meaning to be, you know, tough about it, or not meaning to be knuckleheaded about it, who cares? What matters is what God thinks. What matters is what His Word says. But our culture says, oh, no, you must consider all options equal. They're not equal. God's way is the way. Do we see that? Maybe some have a great deal to change and overcome in their lives because they've settled into a certain life. Maybe some have to change jobs. Maybe some find trouble within their families, as Jesus prophesied himself during his ministry. I'm not come to bring peace but a sword, and a man's foes will be they of his own household. That's a challenge. How do you deal with it? They especially have to heed another parable, the parable of the sower. Remember, that is where the seed is scattered apparently sort of randomly and uniformly scattered about, but what happens to that seed depends on the receptivity of the soil, if I can put it that way. And I think you can see the connection. The baggage they brought from the world can be a challenge to these laborers. It can. Luke 9, might want to keep your place just for reference, but Luke 9, verses 57 to 62, might be the steward's loving warning to this group. Luke 9, 57. It says, now it happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, Lord, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Then he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. I have other things going on in my life. Jesus said, let the dead bury their own dead. You go and preach the kingdom of God. Is that heartless? Or is it helping to focus? Another said, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid them farewell at my house. It's not a quick wave as you go by. That's not what was implied. I think we understand. Jesus said to him, "No one, having put his hand to the plow, looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God." Focus, focus, focus. Don't get distracted by what you came out of, midday laborers. Don't leave the Father's vineyard. You have found something priceless. And it doesn't matter what the cost is. Focus. The midday laborers, too, must work until end of shift. Then there are the end of shift laborers, those few who, you know, there's a time when evening arrives in a person's life, in a day. When the shift is nearly done. Just be honest about it. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 27 and 28, I'm going to read from Phillips' translation called the New Testament in Modern English. Here's how J.B. Phillips' translation renders verses 27 and 28 from Hebrews 9. "And just as surely as it is appointed for all men to die once, and after that to pass to their judgment, so it is certain that Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many, and after that, to those who look for him, he will appear a second time, not this time to deal with sin," that was his first coming, "but to bring to full salvation those who eagerly await him." That's when the wages are handed out, aren't they? At end of shift. That's when the wages are handed out. There's an interesting phrase in Revelation 14, verse 12, in the context of the 144,000. There's a reference made to something called the patience of the saints. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. That requires patience to carry that through to end of shift. There comes a time when my shift ends and your shift ends. The impact on the other laborers should continue. Bottom line, we don't precisely know when that end of shift is for each of us. I doubt if David Hegville thought as he left for the feast in Hawaii that end of shift would be during the feast. We didn't know him well. We knew him a little bit. For some, it will literally be at the return of Jesus Christ, those who are changed at his coming. For others, sooner. Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 9. "Beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you, things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this manner." Warnings can be issued out of loving concern. But as he says, we are confident of better things. We believe you do have the focus. It's just a reminder. "For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you've shown toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints," and you do minister. You are working through the heat of the day. You are working no matter what the shift hours turn out to be. And you haven't quit. You are still in the vineyard. "We desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end." Mr. Horchak's message, where we were for the feast. "That you do not become sluggish," some of the dangers for various laborers in the vineyard, "but you imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises." An echo of Revelation 14:12. That's the instruction to us all. Focus. 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 Where are we looking? We come back to the question I asked early on. Where is your focus? Go back to the 121st Psalm. Somebody I know spoke on the Psalms of Ascents not too long ago. Psalm 121. a song of ascents. I will lift up my eyes to the hills, from whence comes my help. My help comes from the Lord, the Eternal, who made heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. He is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Eternal shall preserve you from all evil, keep you. He shall preserve your soul. He shall preserve your going out and your coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. And you can visualize them stepping up to the next step and reciting the next psalm. My wife and I have stood on those steps, next to the ancient wall in Jerusalem. Remember, we must all work until the job is done, until end of shift. Welcome home from the feast, everybody. Where's your focus?